session number 11449.
Real 2.
Squadron leader down, Real 2. You are talking about the German guns as compared with ours.
Yes, they had that lethal cannon firing through their propeller. Hispano Suiza, I think, wasn't it? I'm not sure. And it was a very fine gun. Much longer range than our ball ammunition, 303. It was my view that ball and tracer were useless. The armor piercing was useful, but the best of the lot was the explosive De Wilde ammunition, and you used to get one belt of that because it was in so short supply, very scarce. There used to be one De Wilde bullet in every three, and that was an explosive bullet, and that was the nearest we had to match the Hispano Suiza cannon, which used explosive ammunition.
So was there considerable frustration in being able to hit?
No frustration. It was just a comment of us all that we were at a disadvantage there. Ammunition for ammunition and firepower. And we had a disadvantage in engines as well. The Rolls-Royce engine couldn't be flown in the inverted position. Violent manoeuvres often used to stall it, whereas the Daimler-Benz, of course, was fuel-injected, and that could have been flown in any position, inverted or... and it was better again. That's my view. I would have preferred that engine to the Merlin.
Would you have preferred the 109 to the Hurricane?
No.
Why not?
Nasty, smelly aircraft. Ersatz smell. Filthy smell to be beside. And when I had the chance of flying one in the Western Desert, which was captured, I think it was at an airfield called Gambert, Maine, it was very cramped. Very cramped, and I didn't care for it at all. Very difficult to land as well. You had to put it down on its two front wheels and then let the tail come down. As opposed with the Hurricane, you could just plonk it down on its three points with no difficulty. And it used to stay there.
What happened to you after these operations over Dunkirk?
We plugged on. It was then the Battle of Britain. We had to reform on two occasions because of loss of pilots again. One became rather a stranger, really. I eventually found myself as the oldest inhabitant of the squadron in September 1940, and I felt rather unhappy because all my friends had gone, some posted and some killed. We were sent to Boscombe Down in the middle of September 1940 to reform, and I led the remnants of the squadron there because our CO at the time wasn't all that brilliant. Although I was only a flying officer, And when I got there to Boscombe Down, we were of course given a week's leave and that sort of thing. But I asked to see, it was, Boscombe Down came into 10 group, we, Northfield being in 11 group, so that was my first encounter with 10 group. And I asked to see the AOC of 10 group, who was Air Marshal Sir Christopher Quinton Brand. And to my surprise, he appeared 2 days later and led me to under a tree near a dispersal point, away from everyone else, and said, what do you want to see me about? And I just said that I wanted a break. I explained that I seemed to be doing all the work, partly because the lack of experience of anyone else. I knew my England without looking at a map and could fly anywhere within reason, whereas the squadron command at the time didn't have the ability to do so. And I said, I wanted a break. And he was a nice chap. He didn't mince his words. He said, all right, nice to have spoken to you. And he gave me a pat on the shoulder and left. And I didn't know what was going to happen then. But 3 or 4 days later, the signal came through and said that I could take myself off as an instructor to Sutton Bridge.
So the summer of 1940 wasn't a happy period for you?
No.
Were the people coming into the squadron very green then?
Yes, very green. They couldn't help it. They're very keen, wonderfully keen. But one didn't know them, and due to their lack of experience, one didn't sort of really trust them to stay close to you.
What typically might they do which was disturbing?
Well, they didn't have the experience in formation flying, you see, and you had to make some fairly violent manoeuvres without any warning at all, which you could do with your old colleagues, but you couldn't with youngsters without the experience. And you were really thinking of two things. You were not only thinking of the enemy, your own protection, but you were also thinking of, I must do this manoeuvre gently and precise and give warning, otherwise you might get rammed. You're having far more to think about.
During the Battle of Britain, where typically would you be operating over?
Over the our sector mainly, which was Essex, Suffolk, Kent, and of course the English Channel, which one was over daily. One knew the sight of the ground like the back of your hand. And the site, of course, of the French coast and the Belgian coast. You knew exactly where you were at any moment, as long as you could see it through the clouds.
What would a typical operation in the Battle of Britain be like for you personally?
Sometimes it used to last for 15 minutes, and sometimes it used to last an hour, the flight.
And were you mostly attacking the German bombers?
No, a mixture. Sometimes you weren't attacking anything, because you used to go up and couldn't find anything. I was never a great believer in the idea that the ground control was much help to one, the radar people. It was much easier to find the enemy by watching the AK-AK shells bursting and the vapor trails. You knew exactly where to go before the ops room came onto you.
And that method worked, did it?
Oh, yes. You could see where the action was.
Did the Germans usually have the advantage of height over you?
I should say so, yes. Yes. The Hurricane, you see, its operational height was 15,000 feet. And the German aircraft could, fighter aircraft, that is, the ME-109s and 110s, they could operate at a far greater height.
So you were always at a disadvantage?
Yes, we were usually climbing our way up when the Germans were already up.
Were you shot down?
No.
Did you shoot anything down?
Yes.
Can you remember any incidents where you got successes?
No, just in the middle of a melee, and then one... I think I'm only credited with four aircraft.
What were they?
They were 110s and 109s.
Was the 110 easier to deal with than the single seater?
Well, we had better maneuverability than that fellow. Yes. Yes.
Do you remember whereabouts you shot them down?
Gravesend and over the Thames estuary. The usual spot.
How frightening was it going into action against superior numbers?
Well, of course, you didn't know you were going into superior numbers until you actually saw them, or they saw you, and you found yourself surrounded by them. But it was always a moment of anxiety, being sent off into action. Anxiety.
Did you have any sense in the Battle of Britain that the fate of the country depended on you?
No. You had a vague idea that it was a serious matter, but the idea of gloom, doom and panic never entered one's head at all, because one was so young.
Did you feel that the Germans might manage to invade?
Oh, no. There was an occasion when we were reforming at Boscombe Down in the middle of September, that all the church bells started to ring, and in the middle of the night, I think, or midnight, and the squadron commander I walked into my bedroom, woke me up and said, "The show has started. Can you shoot down to the dispersal point?" And I said, "What now?" And he said, "Well, perhaps not now, because we've got no instructions just yet, but I gather the show has started." And I said, "Well, leave it at that." And I turned over and went to sleep again.
The show being the invasion?
Yes.
What did you think of the tactics which the German fighters used in the Battle of Britain?
I didn't think about it at all.
Were you flying in threes or fours?
We were flying in threes all the time.
Did you feel happy about that?
Well, it's what we'd always done. Hadn't done it any other way. The only time I started to fly in a different formation, which was in pairs, was when I went to the Western Desert.
So you've explained earlier how you went off to the training in
yes.
September 1940.
Yes.
Can you say a little bit about what that involved?
Well, that was training youngsters to become fighter pilots. Operational Training Unit, which was number 6 at Sutton Bridge in Lincolnshire, which is near King's Lynn, on the edge of the Wash.
In what kind of mood did the young men come to you?
Full of the joys of spring.
Looking forward to it?
Yes.
What was your main problem in training them?
No problems at all. It was very enjoyable. The youngsters were very keen, and I found myself back with old friends again, who were being rested or from operational flying, such as myself. Derek Dowding was one I remember. Dickie Martin. McGuire, he was the CFI, Chief Flying Instructor. Edwards Jones was the station commander, a wing commander he was then. And they all greeted you, you know. It was an enjoyable 6 months. We were training Poles, French, Norwegians, English, of course. I remember there was a Captain Odd Bull, who was a Norwegian. He eventually became head of the Norwegian Air Force at the end of the war.
Could you tell when somebody came to you very quickly whether they'd make a pilot or not?
Oh, they'd all passed that stage. They were all qualified pilots. They were just being taught fighter tactics and how to fly in formation. They'd all got past that stage.
You then joined 232 Squadron.
Yes.
In May 41.
Yes. That was as a flight commander.
Whereabouts were you based then?
That was at Euston near Newcastle on the Tyne.
And what duties did the squadron
play? Well, there again, we were back to this old patrolling over convoys and single ships coming into Newcastle. And if there was any German reconnaissance aircraft snooping about, well, then we had to go and try and find him. But I never could. The radar wasn't that good. In fact, I didn't think it was any good at any time. We used to play a crazy game in the early days of the war with Bordsey, which was the home of the experimental home of this radar, or radio location, as it was called then. Watts and Company used to be there. And they were convinced that the interceptions weren't being all that good, if any good, because the Germans were barely picking up the messages and acting on a reciprocal course. So we were given what were called Freddy vectors to fly. Instead of saying alter course to 110 or alter course fly on a vector of 320, they used to say Freddy vector 320, which meant you had to fly on the opposite direction. This was to fool the enemy. In fact, all it did was to thoroughly confuse the controller on the ground, because he didn't know which way we were flying. It was only just fortunate that we were like pigeons and we knew the way back.
So it proved to be totally useless.
Utterly useless. That's my view. We used to go round and round in circles, this way, that way, heaven knows where. And in the end, we used to lose all contact because the controller at the other end hadn't the slightest idea what he was doing anyway. All this Freddy vectoring business. And as I say, we just used to act like pigeons and we knew the way home. We knew which way it was, how to come home.
Were these convoy patrols exactly similar to those that
the early ones? Yes, the early ones, but they used to be smaller. There wasn't so much minesweeping going on up there, you see. The Smoky Joes.
Smoky Joes?
Well, they were the old trawlers converted to minesweepers. Coal burning, lots of black smoke coming out. They weren't supposed to make it, but they couldn't help it, poor things. That's how their boilers worked with coal. We called Smoky Joes.
Was German intervention much greater, though, than the earlier days of convoy patrols?
No, the German activity in the early days was minor, hardly anything. I think they were just practicing over their own land and building up their air force like we were trying to build ours up.
In April 42, you went off to the Western Desert to command 112 Squadron.
Yes.
How did you get there?
I asked to go. Exactly the same thing as I had done earlier, asking to be transferred from 56 Squadron. I must have spent 3.5 or so years with 56. I did the same thing when I was with 232. I find it rather dull up at Newcastle. And I asked to be transferred to somewhere a bit more active, and I asked to go to the Western Desert. And the best thing about Fighter Command was they always sent you wherever you wanted to go, providing it wasn't somewhere sissy. They were marvellous. They always sent you wherever you wanted to go. That's if they liked you. No difficulty at all.
Providing it wasn't somewhere sissy, you mean?
Well, providing it wasn't a, shall we say, the safest part to be.
How did you get out to North Africa?
Oh, we had a most enjoyable 2 months sea trip on a Union Castle boat called the Cape Town Castle, which was a lovely liner. We went right out into the middle of the Atlantic, way down into the South Atlantic, and right round to Cape Town, where we got off and spent 3 weeks there while they found another boat for us, which happened to be the Holland-America Line, New Amsterdam, and that was a wonderful ship, and that took us up to Suez.
You had hurricanes with the squadron, did you?
In the Western Desert, no, they were awful things called Curtiss Kitty Hawks.
Had you had hurricanes with 232 squadron?
Yes, yes.
Why were the Kitty Hawks so horrible?
Well, in my view, they weren't an operational aircraft compared to the Hurricane or Spitfire.
Can you be more specific?
Well, they were slower, they were more lumbering, they only had 4 guns. They didn't have the manoeuvrability, they didn't have the power. I used to think they were underpowered. There again, they were tricky to land because they had a very narrow undercarriage. I sent a note actually to Middle East headquarters saying, and in my view these weren't, the Kitty Hawk was not an operational aircraft in the accepted sense, and couldn't we be supplied with some Hurricanes or Spitfires? And I got a rude note back saying, you're not to spread alarm and despondency.
So you were stuck with them?
Yes.
What were the problems of operating in the different climatic conditions of the Sahara Desert?
Well, it was all very basic. You lived in tents. You were covered in sand. There were everlasting camseens, which is another word for sandstorms. You were eating and breathing sand. You felt terribly healthy for some reason. It was a pity about the aeroplanes, because of course they were the pretty lumbering, underpowered things. The Americans may have thought they were marvellous, but we didn't, compared with our own aircraft. They were slow to get up to any height at all. But I suppose they were useful, better than nothing.
Whereabouts were you based in the Western Desert?
Gambit, which was a little south of Tobruk, a little south and inland from Tobruk. When one took off, one could look over and see Tobruk on the coast side.
What was it, just a flat piece of desert?
Yes, that's all. Just flattened with some, I think they used to spread sea water on it out of tankers and flatten it. Bits of scrub sticking up. There were no soft bits anyway. The 112 squadron was an entirely Australian manned squadron. And the airmen and mechanics and armourers, adjutant, store equipment officer, warrant officer, station warrant officer, all the pilots, both commissioned and non-commissioned, were all Aussies, Australians. I was the only Pommy there. But I fooled them a bit, because I said I was a Guernseyman, which I am, and they hadn't the slightest idea where Guernsey was or what it was, so I was a bit of a problem to them. But it worked. I wasn't called a Pommy bastard from then on. They didn't have the slightest idea about discipline, drill, or anything. They used to walk about in their Australian hats, those things turned up on one side, with a mixture of